Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran with your morning drive at 6. It's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in. One artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Dan Feinberg writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and he joins us every other week to talk about television. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And he joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV, and we welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right, sir. How are you?
I'm okay, okay.
Did you have a pleasant Thanksgiving?
Absolutely. Had a fine time with my parents and with some of their neighbors and friends. You'd be shocked to discover we spent a lot of time talking about television. So, you know, how about you?
It was great. I'm an only child, so it was just me and my folks. We had dinner, and then Antenna TV was running an all-day marathon of All in the Family. So we basically...
That was a fine way to spend the holiday.
We basically chatted and watched about 4 hours of All in the Family. And they, you know, they handpicked them. There were no later episodes. They were all from the... You know, they picked the good ones. When So, like, before he bought... Before Danielle Bouzbah came in, before Edith died, before he bought Kelsey's, all the, you know, like, the strong stuff. So, and the last episode that we watched together before I went home for the evening was the Sammy Davis Jr. episode.
Which is a classic. I have large All in the Family gaps, without any question, but that one is absolutely, and without question, a classic.
You know, it's funny. It's not funny. Ron Glass passed away last week, but one of the ones that they showed during the marathon was the classic one, which is like Rashomon, where they go out to dinner, and each character tells their version of the story with the... where the refrigerator repairmen come in. Do you remember that one, Dan?
Which is one that I have not seen.
Oh,
so.
You got to see it. You got to see it. It's great. But Ron Glass plays the assistant to the repairman. And when Archie tells the story, you know, in flashback, of course, he's a radical, pulls a switchblade on Archie. And they're at dinner, you know, they're at dinner out in the restaurant telling the story. And then when Mike tells the story, of course, he's an Uncle Tom. Yes, sir, and stuff like that, and Archie screams at him the entire time. But then it's Edith who tells the story that actually happened and how it really happened. It's a great episode. Great episode.
Huh. Yeah. Next Thanksgiving, I will have to keep my eye out for it.
It's a great one, and Ron Glass on the episode was great. He was terrific. And that's, you know, we can start with Florence Henderson. You wrote a piece about Florence Henderson. Remembering Why Comfort TV Matters. Talk a little bit about the piece you wrote, Dan.
I wrote about Comfort TV because that's what people had been asking me about all week. I'd done a number of interviews for newspapers and a couple TV station stuff talking about Gilmore Girls and talking about This Is Us and talking about whether in our post-Trump, or I guess not post-Trump, I guess in Trump's America, if what we're going to need more and more and more is comfort food TV, is TV that makes us feel better about ourselves. And, you know, so when Florence Henderson died, that was where my mind went first, was to the idea that Brady Bunch was not a show that depicted the late 60s and early 70s with any particular accuracy. It was not a show that will ever be hailed as groundbreaking in its depictions of so many different things, but it is a show that for so many different people, it represents to them an idealized but a comforting version of what a blended family is and can be like. And it you know, is a show that lingers because certain parts of it are unstuck in time in ways that make it universal. And it's the same, honestly, when we talked and when I talked with other people about Gary Marshall, when Gary Marshall died, it's the part of the resonance of the things that Gary Marshall did so well and that Florence Henderson brought to Brady Bunch is a timelessness that's comforting and that's reassuring and that only some shows today have. Certainly some shows have them, but not enough, maybe.
It's an interesting thing. I've often gone back when I'm, you know, when I'm feeling low or crappy, I've often gone back to that comfort TV stuff. I often do. I've found myself now over the past couple of weeks watching old reruns of What's My Line with John Daly, and just loving it. You know, like just thinking it's just so great. And they have a channel here. I don't know if you have it in LA, but called Buzzer TV. It's like Game Show Network, except they show old game shows, not new.
Except they show game shows.
Exactly. And but they have in the great, you know, the old What's My Line and To Tell the Truth, those great panel shows from the 50s, which I just love. They have also have the old commercials that they keep in. So for like the Remington Blades and Stop at Antiperspirant, and that stuff is just, I don't know, it just makes you feel good when you watch it. And that's one of the reasons why we watched All in the Family. You know, I mean, that's a show that's a groundbreaking show, obviously, but it still brings you back to where you were maybe when you watched it the first time.
But it's still funny, though, that a show that made people or made some people as uncomfortable as that show made people at the time, that it could now somehow become comfort TV.
Yeah.
Because certainly All in the Family was not avoiding the very things that Brady Bunch was glossing over or pretending simply weren't happening in the world.
Yeah.
And it made people concerned. It made people worried. It made people uncomfortable. And now the idea that you can go back to something like that and it feels like, I don't know, it feels like home, but it feels like a world that we would like to have believed that we moved past and matured past. And apparently if you watch the news, you know, Archie Bunker is different from today's archetypes because he was fairly well-meaning at almost every point, even if he was often a well-meaning bigot.
Yeah.
And I guess we would like to believe in a perfect world that all of our bigots are as well-meaning as Archie Bunker. And I think too often we see that they're not.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting, you know, it is interesting that in the context of what's happening now and you know, the temperament of what's happening in our society right now, to actually find All in the Family, like, innocent and fun. You're absolutely right. That's very, very bizarre. But, you know, and again, while watching that show, astounded by how much, you know, they got away with and, you know, how many episodes that we watched could never be made today.
They could be made, but maybe they'd have to be made on cable.
Right,
or you'd
right.
look at something, or you'd look at something like Black-ish, which is a show that tries to do many of the same things. That certainly is indebted to the Norman Lear legacy in many ways. But you know, I don't think we try that hard most shows these days. But you look on cable and you see. Well, because we wouldn't be having a conversation if we didn't talk about Atlanta.
I was just going to say it only took about 6 minutes for us to get to Atlanta.
I saw it coming up on the highway, and I'm like, well, I could take a different exit, or I could just accept the fact that there it is. It's on the horizon. Atlanta is a show that does those things.
Yeah.
Survivor's Remorse, which is a show that I love, is a show that does those things. The good, smart comedies still can get away with the things that All in the Family got away with,
yeah.
But maybe there are too many shows that are too visible that don't attempt to.
Yeah, and you mentioned this whole thing got started because we were talking about the passing of Florence Henderson, and she was just so identified with Carol Brady, but she did so much more. That's another thing about, you know, everybody immediately thinks Carol Brady, but she did a lot of other stuff. And she did some edgy stuff and she was really funny in so many different ways. For God's sake, she's in Shakes the Clown. And you know, and it's one of my favorite moments it's the beginning of the movie. It's one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. So I think she will always be, you know, the 70s mom. But she's more than that.
She is. And she always had a good humored way of playing off of that image in the years afterwards. You know, she's Carol Brady. I'm not going to.
Yeah.
I am an appreciator of Shakes the Clown as much as many people. Some people, I'm going to guess not as much as you, but as much as or more than most people.
Right.
I can go that way. But yeah, you know, there are a lot of people who get kind of pigeonholed in those sitcom roles. And I want to go, oh, there's so much more than that. But I think that it was important how much Florence Henderson was Carol Brady and how much she brought to that and how much, I don't know, the two parents in that show were able to carry it over a lot of acting limitations from some of the younger thespians who grew up variably awkward and variably able to act, but, you know, had their moments.
Yeah.
But the parents anchor the show, and of course Alice. I mean, you know, the grown-ups anchor the show.
As I mentioned, we also lost Ron Glass last week. Now, were you a fan of Barney Miller?
Barney Miller, I have even more gaps, I think, probably than All in the Family, but certainly I've watched my share of Barney Miller episodes as well, and you know, respect the heck out of that show. I think that was a show that was way the heck ahead of its time in so many different ways, and you know, I feel like we only just lost Abe Vigoda, but when was that? God, when did Abe Vigoda
die? 2 years. 2 years, I think it's been 2 years.
It couldn't possibly be that long, could it?
I think so.
No. He was 2016 too. That was January.
Was he? Oh, he was. Yeah, that's right. He was.
This is all 2016.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, 2016 has been a brutal year, and I keep mentioning to people that people are going to die in 2017. It's not just going to be a 1 year phenomenon, but man. It does feel as if 2016 has been extra brutal.
Yeah, it really, really has. And it's funny you mention Abe Vigoda. I screened for my film club screening last week. I screened The Godfather on the big screen.
That would be a good one to screen.
Beautiful. And like, you know, just Tessio coming in for old time's sake. Everybody in the theater was like, "Oh, Abe," you know.
Well, for so long he was the one who was still alive. He was the one who had survived everything, and now not. So Ron Glass too, and yesterday Grant Tinker, who was the famous NBC executive who launched basically all of your favorite NBC shows from the early 80s, from Cheers to The Cosby Show to Hill Street Blues, et cetera, he died, and he's an utter TV titan, just one of the legends of the past 40 years of TV. So certainly a lot of people from a lot of familiar classic TV moments passing in the past week.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break and come back and get happy. Okay, Dan?
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. We're going to take a break. Dan Feinberg is here. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. We got to take a break for news. When we come back, we'll talk more TV with Dan right here on 720 WGN. All right. We're back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the show. Coming up a little bit later on, we are going to talk about the worst rock bands in the history of music. That's going to be coming up. Esmeralda and I are going to play another edition of Pop-Up Video. And we got more coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, Triple Play Thursday, one artist, three songs, Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. That's our number. We're talking currently with Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. Well, let's get to Gilmore Girls. Now, I read the piece that you wrote in Hollywood Reporter. We can't do that here. Obviously, because it was a spoiler filled piece, and I don't want to do that, but I do want to talk about Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. And your piece, by the way, was really great. I particularly enjoyed your possible scenarios for the last four words at the beginning, and because you kind of go through every scenario possible.
You know, everyone was taking everyone takes it as such a foregone conclusion. And again, we're not going to spoil anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, but people are taking foregone conclusions. And I'm suggesting there are a lot of possibilities still at play and that I don't necessarily need any of them to come back. Because I feel like, to me, the last four words felt like they did what they needed to do. And now life can move on, and hopefully Amy Sherman-Palladino can do more good stuff, having satisfactorily felt like she ended the series that got taken away from her. But how did you actually feel? Because when we last talked, I had seen it, but you had not.
Well, it started airing at 2 a.m. here, so I didn't move from the couch from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m. on Friday morning. That's basically that's what I loved it. I you know, the issues that you have with it are certainly valid, and I agree with many of them. I think the two episodes that that Amy Sherman-Palladino wrote and directed are stronger than the ones that her husband did, the two that her husband did. particularly Fall, which I've watched, like you, I've watched Fall twice. I've watched the other three just the one time, but I've watched Fall twice, and I think it's the best of the four shows. Winter would be second on my list, and that's mostly due to the stuff between the magnificent Kelly Bishop, who is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned, between her and Lauren Graham. That stuff was stellar and just wonderful, and I found myself like crying through most of the episode. But yeah, I mean, I had issues with some of it. The one thing that I will say that I totally agree with you on, the major problem that I had was in the summer episode with that musical. It made me nuts that they dedicated that much screen time to not only showing the musical numbers, but then rehashing them with dialogue after showing the musical numbers. And you said it, you know, like you said in your piece, it grinds it to a complete halt, and that's exactly what it did.
And it does, but I guess part of how I look at it is that, and I said this in my piece as well, that I feel like she really wanted to do about 2 hours, and yeah. Netflix wasn't going to give her money to do 2 hours. So rather than doing a 2-hour reunion movie where it was 30 minutes of everybody coming and going, hi, what up? And this is what I've been doing for 8 years, and then closing basically with the last episode. There was some filler, and the musical stuff is the most fillery of the filler.
Oh yeah,
it doesn't pretend to be anything else.
Yeah,
it's just filler.
Yeah, no, it's the most blatant filler in the series, and there is a lot of filler in it. But I got to tell you, I had fun watching the filler. I really did. As a fan of the show, I was happy and I was really thrilled to see everybody who came back come back. And it's this thing. It's like you don't watch South Park, do you, Dan?
Not anymore.
Okay. Well, this season that they're doing right now, the main element is this thing called member berries. And there are these evil little berries that say, member Star Wars, member the... people eat the member berries, and they're in this trance where they remember things from the past that they liked. Like, we were just talking about Comfort Television. And that's how I felt when I was watching Gilmore Girls. There wasn't a lot of substance going on. A lot of it wasn't moving the story along. Some of it was going down roads that I didn't care about. But just seeing those people and being in Stars Hollow, you know, I got to say, it was enough for me, man. It really was.
And that's what it's there for, and I think a lot of it works very well. And honestly, with the musical stuff, I really will watch Sutton Foster and Christian Borle
sure.
sing and dance happily. I might complain a little bit because it's keeping me from what I was actually there to be watching.
Right.
But whatever. Those are talented enough people that I can find brief bits of mirth in what is an overly extended and occasionally painful bit of unnecessary filler that really connects with absolutely nothing except for the brief conclusion with the musical number that Sutton Foster sang beautifully and Lauren Graham reacted to beautifully. And it's a payoff, but
yeah.
it's not.
Yeah.
Necessary.
Well, and there were other things. There were, you know, like I know that like Amy Sherman-Palladino loves to throw in, you know, like rapid fire pop culture references, but there were a couple of references from certain characters that would, like, for instance, would Emily have seen Llewyn Davis?
I have no idea, and that was absolutely and totally a question that I had as well. What was the circumstance in which look, maybe she's a Coen Brothers fan, or honestly, maybe it's, you know, in Grief, she spent a lot of time watching HBO.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's cool.
That's,
and then
that's
the
best I can do.
There were several of those, but that was the most blatant. When she made the Llewyn Davis reference, I'm like, that should have come out of Lorelai's mouth. You know what I mean? But anyway, and then the other one that stuck out for me is like when Carol Kane actually played I Feel the Earth Move, in that universe, did that song not come out? Considering how pop culture related everything in Stars Hollow is, really that song didn't exist in that universe?
For some reason, perhaps yes, there is for some reason there is a Carol King gap in a universe in which Carol King sings the theme song for the universe.
Right.
So you have to pause and go, but I think that was just one of those things where, like, if you have Sutton Foster, you let her sing for as long as
right.
she wants to.
Right.
If you've got Carol King there, let her do her thing. And, the people in the audience who know go, ha ha ha, it's funny, it's Carole King.
Right.
And I would guess a distressing percentage of the audience reacts with confusion. Like probably a percentage that is so high you don't even want to begin to fathom.
Yeah. Well, overall, I got to say, it was a great 6 hours for me. I loved it, and I rewatched Fall, and it made me cry, and I loved the last four words, and I thought it was great closure, especially coming from someone who was so passionate about the show, except for season seven. It was for me as a huge Gilmore Girls fan. It was exactly what I wanted. Flawed, but exactly what I wanted, and emotionally, the ending was perfect, I thought.
And it really was comfort food designed for the holiday weekend in a time when people wanted and needed comfort food. So I think it served the purpose it was intended for the most part.
And, you know, again, judging by and again, Netflix, you never know how well things do on Netflix. But judging by social media, everybody watched it, you know.
Absolutely, but a lot of people did seem to dislike it. I have a lot of friends and colleagues and people on Twitter and et cetera who were not as happy as you were, certainly, as I was. Some people were genuinely unhappy. There was a large number of people who were sort of shocked by the idea that that Rory is slightly insufferable, as if Rory hadn't been slightly insufferable for... well, seven seasons, but certainly for three or four.
Right.
Like, where were those people, and did they not notice this is not new? If you go back and watch, that's what Rory is.
Yep.
It's who the character is. But also, that's okay. Sometimes people are really just annoying, and if Rory Gilmore happens to be one of them, well, it's just one of life's little tragedies.
Yeah. No, and you wrote about it very, very interestingly in the piece, you know, analyzing Rory's character and possibly Bledel's shortcomings as an actress. Is that what it is? We don't know. And that's
exactly.
What
exactly. We don't know.
But as flawed as she is, and she would drive me crazy. And I'm not just talking about these four episodes, as you just mentioned, Dan. Seven seasons of Rory making me nuts. Like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, what are you doing? It was just, you know, especially with her choices with men. I just, it's crazy.
And the idea that she was supposed to have improved or matured in nine seasons, well, the plot was that she didn't. So there you go.
Right, exactly. I will say this. Every guy that she ever dated during the course of the series, I hated. I hated all of them. I especially hated Jess. Jess made me nuts. I hated Logan, too, but Jess made me nuts. But I got to say, the use of Jess in A Year in the Life, I thought was perfect. It was absolutely what he should have done. And it was the absolute right amount of Jess in the show, and I thought they handled Jess really well in the Year in the Life.
I thought insofar as he was only there very briefly. Yeah. Similarly, they handled Dean exactly perfectly.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, all right, Dan, hang on. We got to talk about more than Gilmore Girls, and we will.
Excellent. So
hang on a second. Dan Feinberg is with us. We spent a lot of time talking about Gilmore Girls. I mean, for God's sake, it's the TV story of the year so far. Okay, we got to take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk more TV with Dan Feinberg. You can read him, follow him on Twitter and Facebook at TheFineprint, FIEN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hi, we are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And we're coming up a little bit later on. Triple Play Thursday is in full effect. If you want to make your request, one artist, three songs, you pick them. 312-981-7200. Coming up a little bit later on, we're going to talk about the worst bands in rock music history. That's coming up. And it all has to do with a news story featuring Nickelback. So we'll talk about that. But we're talking TV right now with our good friend Dan Feinberg. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at TheFineprint, FIEN. And we got more TV to talk about. And welcome back, Dan. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All righty, then. So, listen, I'm fascinated, and I've not watched it, but this Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath TV series, it's a documentary series. I find it really fascinating. Tell everybody about this, and you've seen it.
I've seen the first episode, the first episode, because it is a work in progress for A&E. It premiered on Tuesday night, I guess. Mm-hmm. And basically the point is that Leah Remini was in Scientology for around 35 years, and she exited very, very publicly and acrimoniously in around 2013, and she's written a very successful memoir about it, and she's continued to talk about it. And so this is basically her way of continuing to talk about it, and also to get stories from other people who were part of Scientology and have horror stories to tell, but horror stories within a certain range, because the show has been legaled within an inch of its life. It begins every segment with a black card emphasizing that the Church of Scientology disagrees with everything that's being said in the series and directing people to a website on A&E where they can read the full explanations from Scientology, not really explanations so much as slurs about everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. Every person who appears on the camera, the Church of Scientology has a black card and a letter explaining their point of view on it. It's a very, very precisely legal series, but it's interesting. I don't think it's really revelatory. Like, if you watch the Alex Gibney Scientology documentary from a couple of years ago, if you've watched, honestly, any of many Scientology docs or news reports, probably you're going to know everything that's in it. But it's a human face on it. And Leah Remini is an engaging personality. And this is something that she obviously feels deeply about at this moment, and so it's interesting to watch. It's not great, and a lot of people are going to feel like it doesn't give them anything they didn't have before, but there definitely is some courage to what she's doing on the assumption that you believe her, believe her, basically.
Okay, all right. And now, is it how many episodes total? And you said it's a work in progress, but...
It's 8 episodes, and when I say it's a work in progress, there, the letters that I mentioned from the church explaining things about, basically saying mean things about the people Leah Remini is interviewing, they're dated on the screen. And one of the letters full of quotes saying mean things about someone is dated November 2nd or 3rd of this year.
Wow.
So like 3 weeks ago. And basically I assume that that is happening with every single episode where everything is getting vetted to avoid extensive lawsuits and other things so that they can basically put it on the air, because, you know, the Church of Scientology is a wee bit litigious. They're a little bit protective of their image, even still at this point. I assume they're going to be editing each of these episodes pretty much until the moment at which they air. And so the scenes from the rest of the season, they sort of tease kind of titillating things like, is Leah going to be followed by investigators from the church trying to shut her down? Will she become paranoid about them trying to stop her in her quest for truth? And I'm kind of wondering if this is going to become a thriller at some point, or if it's really going to be an anthology of personal stories. So we'll see.
Okay. All right. I was intrigued by it. And when does it air?
It airs on Tuesday nights, probably at 9 in your time zone, I believe.
Okay.
And it did very well in its first episode. And assuming that it's not too much work for the legal team, I would assume that probably as long as it airs, more and more people will get in contact with Leah Remini and will attempt to get their stories out there as well.
Right.
So it's the kind of thing that doesn't need to stop after 8 episodes. There are a lot of people who left the Church of Scientology and presumably have some stories. So if this is a vehicle or an avenue for those stories to get out there, I assume that Leah Remini will be happy to be a vessel for the stories to be told through.
And if people are interested, if people found this interesting and have not seen, you mentioned the Alex Gibney documentary that was on HBO. That thing was amazing.
What that one did so well was it combined a lot of little bits and pieces from a lot of different sources. It was kind of a compilation reel of things that you might have heard about Scientology that had scared you previously and putting it all out there. Like, I didn't think that it was a deep film, but I thought that it covered a lot of terrain and did it in a way that was easily accessible, which is kind of Alex Gibney's thing, is that he puts a lot of information out there, he makes it digestible, and he lets you process the information. And that, you know, it's a good filmmaking technique. I think some of his films are better when he gets a little bit more emotionally invested, but that's a different conversation,
right?
Probably.
I do want to mention, speaking of documentaries, you know, at the end of the year, the screeners are starting to pile up on my coffee table, as they do at the end of every year. And I did get the screener for O.J. Made in America, for your consideration, best documentary feature. This is really kind of unprecedented that it could win an Emmy for that, and they could win an Oscar. Has that ever been done before?
Well, it has been, and this particular way of doing it is the part that's unprecedented, because a large number of movies have been nominated for both, and I don't know that many have won for both, but you look at something like the Nina Simone doc from a couple of years ago, or I think Going Clear was nominated in both TV and movie worlds. It happens with some regularity because at this moment, the doc marketplace is stronger on TV than in movie theaters, so it's easier for a doc to get made if it has HBO, Showtime, PBS, or apparently ESPN money behind it. And,
right.
And that means that it actually is being made for a place, and then simultaneously those docs get a week or two in theaters and play festivals and whatever, and then get eligible for awards in movies. So it does happen. This one is just so unique because the format of it is so unique, and because it's so very much a mini series, but it did premiere at Sundance in 8 only barely interrupted hours. It has played in cities around the country.
Yeah, it played here, and it was very successful. It played here at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
It's done its theatrical due diligence. It's just sort of funny that it is still very much an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary.
Yeah, I know.
Albeit the best, and then you're opening whole other cans of worms that I think a lot of people would prefer not to answer. They'd prefer to just put it in the documentary category, and, you know, yep.
Yep, Dan Feinberg is with us. We got a break for the news, and then we'll come back. You can follow him, by the way, on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print, and we'll come back after the news and talk more TV with Dan. Morning, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower overlooking beautiful Michigan Avenue. We are here till 5 every weekday morning, 2 to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and at 6 a.m., the great Steve Cochran for your morning drive. Coming up, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about the worst rock bands in history and another battle between Esmeralda and I playing the old pop-up video. That's all coming up. Right now, though, we're still talking with Dan Feinberg. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And he joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. And we welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Nick.
All right. So I have to ask you about this, the documentary, HBO documentary about the Boston Marathon bombing called Marathon, the Patriots Day Bombing. What did you think of it?
I thought it was decent. I thought it was a little distracted and all over the place because there's so much story to tell. And there's so much story to tell, and it tries to tell the story on a number of different fronts. It tries to tell the story as a moment-by-moment breakdown of the Boston Marathon bombing, but also a story of triumph of some of the people recovering from injuries they suffered. But it's not really a triumph story because we're only 3 years after and the wounds are still fresh and raw. And the documentary does actually an excellent job of acknowledging that you don't just recover from something like this overnight. And while there are medical miracles being performed in prosthetics and so many different things, these are scars that will linger on people, on a city, et cetera. And I thought it was solid. And I think that it's a good documentary, and it's almost certain to be a good companion piece or, I don't know, substitute, depending on your point of view, for the Peter Berg movie that I've heard mostly good things about.
Yeah.
With Mark Wahlberg. So that, you know, it to some degree, it feels to me as if this is very soon for these docudramas and documentaries that again the wounds are extra fresh and there's not really a chance to fully reflect on any of it. And that's partly the point with the HBO documentary, is that this is sort of a pain that's a work in progress, and I assume it probably is with the Berg film as well. So, you know, these are complimentary texts, and I will almost certainly see the Peter Berg movie. And, you know, I know some people will feel that it's too soon and that they just don't want to experience this again.
Yeah.
It's so recent.
It's interesting. I mean, we were just talking about FX, the OJ miniseries, and then the documentary, and then now there's this, these two sort of companion pieces.
I think it's probably a reasonable thing to do. The next American Crime Story season, which they still have not given any timetable for, is going to be Hurricane Katrina, and surely whatever that is going to be, you'll be able to watch it next to the Spike Lee HBO documentary to When the Levees Broke, which is a spectacular project from Spike Lee.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it'll be very hard for whatever Ryan Murphy and company come up with on this to equal that, because that is a sort of seminal and defining text.
Absolutely.
And at least apparently this will concentrate on Katrina itself. It won't go after, so it won't have to run into Treme, the David Simon series, which mm-hmm. was probably underrated because it was his follow-up to The Wire, so it's tough to top that.
Right.
But I think that we're seeing a fair amount of kind of mixed use, as it were, approaches to crime and tragedy, and we're trying to grapple with things, and there's no reason why, if you're trying to grapple with the subject, you shouldn't have people tackling it from a nonfiction point of view and people tackling it from a John Travolta point of view.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny you mentioned you contributed to two stories on IndieWire, and it's the best overlooked shows of the year, and you just mentioned American Crime, the second season, and you know, you say this every time, and we always talk about this. The last line in the contribution that you wrote is, "There's just too much great TV," and because you were talking about how American Crime second season, which you thought was much better than the first, might not make your top 10 at the end of the year.
Oh, it's not going to, and I feel bad about it because the first five or six episodes of that second season are really as good as anything on TV this year, and it went a tiny bit off course. It didn't like crash and burn. It didn't become a disaster. It just wasn't as good in the second half as it was in the first. And apparently that's going to be enough to boot it out of my top 10. God, there's so many shows, and there's no room for error when it comes to top 10 lists. And so either you make a top 50 list, which is always a possibility, or you accept that at the end of the year, there are a lot of shows that I loved and love that are not going to make my top 10, and that I'm going to look at numbers 10 through 20 and maybe numbers 20 through 30 and think that in a lot of years, those would have been perfectly serviceable top 10s. It would have reflected a year of great TV. And, you know, in some cases, I'm just not even considering them. I know American Crime is not making my top 10, but that was a really good season of TV, and I would recommend it to everybody without real hesitation. So,
you know, I'm finding it's going to be difficult for me to make my top 10 list of movies. 2016 has been an extraordinarily good year for movies, and some really amazing films have come out. And we put a list of my two contributors and I put a list of top 20 together. And I mean, I think I've already got 20 titles that, you know, and I haven't even seen everything yet. I still haven't seen, you know, some of the major things. And, you know, so I don't know. I mean, you just mentioned in a tweet, you mentioned Manchester by the Sea. That movie gutted me. I mean, good God.
It is a powerful movie, and everybody in it is great, and it does all the things you want a great movie to do. And this is the time of year when I have to try getting out to see a movie or two every weekend, because otherwise that'll snowball and I just won't have seen the movies that I want to have seen, as opposed to the TV shows I need to have seen. So like this past weekend, I finally successfully finished the second season of Kimmy Schmidt. I wanted to make sure I got through it, you know, in case it was going to be a top 10 contender, and it's not, but it, But it's another one where I would tell people without hesitation, watch the second season of Kimmy Schmidt. It's terrific, but it's not going to be in my top 10.
What did you think of the cliffhanger ending?
It suggests interesting things for next season.
Yeah.
It depends a lot on actor availability, is all I will say. So we'll see. But no, I mean, it's a hilarious show when it's at its very best.
Yeah.
And it's probably in my second 10 or maybe even in my third 10. And I consider that to be no slight on Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah. All right. You got to tell me about Search Party. I've got it on my, I've got my DVR set.
Okay. See, I was going to ask about that.
Yes.
Because you should definitely watch Search Party, and I want to hear your reactions to it, because some people are going to hate it. On the other hand, at the Thanksgiving party that I was at, I was surprised by the diverse assortment of people who I wouldn't have necessarily thought would like it and have. It's kind of a oddball, hipster, droll comedy missing person mystery. I compared it to La Ventura as a single camera comedy, and I know that will be absolutely useless for some listeners and will deter some listeners from watching it. And I think probably that's intentional.
And this is on TBS. Tell everybody.
It is on TBS, but it has all premiered. It premiered in a odd 1 week, 2 episodes per night over 5 nights. It's a 10-episode, half-hour episode, so really, really fast, easy to binge. And if you like it, you'll want to binge it. You'll want to, because it is a murder mystery or a missing persons mystery, and there are clues and there are suspects and red herrings and cliffhangers and all of that, and it does drive you along. It's also very funny, and the characters in it are just awful, and it's a funny comedy about self-obsession, but it's also a mystery about self-obsession and when investigation becomes introspection or something to that effect. I think it's really good. At times I think it's great. Also, not going to make my top 10, but a really good show that people should watch, and I think you'll probably like it.
Yeah, so I love the lead. I think
Aaliyah Shawkat.
Yeah, so. She's great, and I loved, I mean, she's in Green Room this year too, for God's sake. So that's a good year. But I'm looking forward to it, and I've been seeing the trailers for it and all over the place, and I'm really looking forward to it. It looks strange, and that's, you know, my cup of tea. So
I think you will like it. I think for some audiences, it's yet another one of those sort of small batch offerings that some people will love and the vast majority of people will not, and bless the TV landscape now for having room for so many shows like that.
Yeah. Is there anything else before we let you go? Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that people should watch, or is there anything?
I'm going to tell people this is a really good time to be catching up on all the great TV they've missed over the years. I think that I don't think anyone has watched everything they need to watch. I certainly haven't. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to tell people is that they should pay attention to the various titles that we've mentioned tonight and in nights past. And, you know, if they haven't watched Baskets, watch Baskets. If they haven't watched Atlanta, watch Atlanta. There are also shows that aren't on FX that they should watch. So,
yeah, we sometimes sound like a paid advertisement for FX when we're talking.
Yeah, we should avoid it. So let's say if they haven't watched Search Party on TBS, they should watch Search Party.
Go.
They should watch Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix. There's too much TV, so take some time to watch it.
Right. Okay. Dan, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, okay?
Always a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, thank you. There's Dan Feinberg. He's great, and he's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Joins us every couple of weeks. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about really bad rock bands right here on 720 WGN.